You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this past week. And our guests this week, are Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. I figure you're here for the week since, you know, you're, every Friday someone's here.
Our guest this minute.
At this very moment. So, Don, you've kind of got some developing news. So let's get right to this. Some news when it comes to Amazon.
Yeah, development news.
Yeah.
I posted this up on BoiseDev.com a little bit ago. Amazon has applied with the city of Boise to convert roughly 80,000 square foot warehouse near the Boise airport. They call it I'm going to use the jargon here, a DID2 distribution facility.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, totally. And I actually emailed Amazon and asked them specifically what that was, and they told me they had nothing to share, which I didn't really ask anything to share. I asked them what the heck it was. It's fine. Not that I'm bitter. But they are working on actually three different facilities in the Treasure Valley. The Idaho Press has reported that they are working on a distribution center in Nampa. And people are like, oh, well, is this that Project Bronco thing? And it isn't. So that would be a fulfillment center. I keep likening it to like a big Costco. It's where they keep all the stuff. The distribution centers are like a waypoint. The items come from elsewhere. They land at the distribution center, and then they're parceled out via the gray trucks you've probably seen around town that say Prime on them. So they've applied to do some demolition here, and no timeline yet. They won't tell me when or what or any actual details, but that's what I know on that.
Well, there you go. So they've at least applied for permits.
Yeah, and it may speed delivery here, delivery speed and some of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
For people who have Amazon and Amazon Prime.
So, Betsy, you have been digging into the issue of paid leave when it comes to state government. So tell us what you've found out about this.
Sure. And so my interest was sparked really when a state tax commissioner, Elliot Work, basically just disappeared from the job for a month. And everyone was like, where did he go? And no one would say. And it's a personnel matter. And then he was back.
Oh.
And no one would say. And it was a personnel matter. And I had done some reporting on this type of thing some years earlier. Back in 2006, there was an employee who then Governor Risch said he was replacing at the Department of Ag. And 7 months later, it turned out the guy was still on the payroll on administrative leave.
For 7 months?
Yes.
Wow.
Full salary. And when you're on administrative leave, you also continue to accrue vacation, retirement, and so forth. It's just as if you were at work. So I wondered.
Except you're not.
Except you don't have to work. So I wondered how much of this is going on now and what has changed since back then in 06. And the state actually has strengthened its rules and laws regarding administrative leave. Back in 06, it could happen for any reason, completely at the discretion of the state or the agency. Now there are some specific reasons. But I examined an 11-month period, and during that time, nearly 3,000 state employees received at least some paid leave. And there were four state employees at four different agencies who were on paid leave continuously from January 7th, when Governor Little took office, to May 31st, which was the end of the time period I was examining.
Wow.
And that seemed kind of surprising.
Wow.
And in almost every case, state employees who were on paid leave for long periods of time were for investigations into complex personnel investigations into some kind of an allegation, such as sexual harassment. And there seemed to be a lot of these. The investigations seemed to be taking a long time. Hmm. And from the human resources experts I've talked with, this also is happening in the private sector. And it is happening more and more in this day and age. But it appears that investigations into this kind of stuff take a lot longer in state government than they do in the private sector. And also in state government, we use paid leave for other things that are not so common in private business, like employees who are reaching the end of their probationary period, their 6 month probation. At the end, if the state decides not to hire them on, they give them 15 days notice and put them on 15 days paid leave, rather than have them continue to work out the final 15 days. It's just part of the practice. So there's a lot of things going on with it. It was really interesting finding out all this information, talking with the governor and the state human resources director about it, and a lot of the agency people. Mm. And the governor says, yes, we have strengthened our rules and laws somewhat, but there may be more we need to do. And since I started asking, he started looking into it.
So when you say, and let's be clear, when you say paid leave, this is that type of administrative paid leave. This isn't someone going on maternity leave or FMLA, you know, something like that.
Correct. This has nothing to do with vacation or anything like that. Oh, another thing that came out in this was that the universities and the law enforcement agencies are among the top users of paid leave.
Is U of I the top?
U of I was the top by far. And the reason for that is because more than half of their employees are on contracts, on 12-month contracts.
Right.
And if they decide in April that they're not going to renew the contract as of July 1, they typically they will have the person work if they can, but if it's somebody who might be disgruntled, who has access to sensitive information, they require them to use up all their vacation and leave, and then they put them on paid leave till the end. So there's a lot of it.
And are you going to be doing more investigating into this or waiting to see what the governor does? I mean, this is fascinating.
Yeah, I've been talking with some legislators now as my next follow-up to see what their impression of this is. And I've talked with some so far who think that what I've turned up shows that maybe our system's working okay, and others who think that, no, we need some tweaks here and that there's more going on here than there ought to be. The numbers really overall compared to the 25,000 state employees are fairly low. But the long stretches, the long time periods, it just, even if it's perfectly normal and acceptable, it kind of sticks in people's craw to think these are taxpayer funds paying someone mm-hmm. to not come to work. So there's a sensitivity to it, and I think there's a desire to make sure that it's held to a minimum.
Well, and you're right, Betsy. It's the idea of maybe the system is working, but why are the investigations taking as long as they are? Mm-hmm. Because if you said there's four state employees that were still on paid leave through the time that you did your investigating, that's what, January 7th to May 31st. And if they were let go, probably June 29th, when the new fiscal year goes into effect on July 1.
And there were 90 state employees who had more than 4 weeks of paid administrative leave during that 11-month period, and 73 of those had more than 5 weeks. On May 31st, I asked just for a single day, there were 30 state employees who were on administrative leave.
Wow. So Mike, you at Six on Your Side have been doing a story about the pet team, and we should clarify this is not about actual pets.
Yeah, that was something we had to actually put in our lead. We're not talking about animals.
Yes.
Right. So it's an emergency team that goes out with the paramedics. It's a paramedic emergency team or psychological emergency team, I think. So it's a group of people, trained professionals or trained volunteers who go out with ambulances in the event of somebody's emergency and help deal with these emergency situations that come up with mental health issues. So even just a couple years ago, if you had an emergency situation, you were largely taken to a hospital, maybe Intermountain Hospital, which if you couldn't afford would go to the county budget. And the county would end up paying for it. So the paramedics have worked with creating this new program, people who are on call. This woman we interviewed sleeps in her uniform and just is ready at any hour to get that call. And they come and they'll show up. They'll take your vital signs and sit and talk with you. They'll do some medication management to make sure that you have that medicine that you need. And a lot of times they avoid putting you in a facility when that facility would either delay your own recovery or end up costing more than whatever they can handle in front of you.
So they're really, I mean, they're saving lives, it sounds like, potentially. But I mean, also, you know, from a budgetary standpoint, you're potentially saving money.
Right. I mean, it's got to be both, right? So, and we've talked before, when we talked to Boise Police, you know, they share that their amount of calls that are just crisis calls are skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. The majority of the time now, police officers and paramedics are showing up to talk people down, to figure out exactly what's going on and try to alleviate the situation and not exacerbate any issues. So this team helps with that. You know, police officers, paramedics, they're trained for something. A lot of times they're not trained for the mental health aspect. Right. As much training as they do receive, right? They're not professionals in that aspect. So having somebody there that can talk somebody down, that can lower the risk of suicidality or cut back on those numbers, especially with marked increases from 2017 to 2018 of that kind of behavior. I mean, you're right. It goes beyond saving money. You're talking about saving lives.
And Don, I kind of like how you've been referring to this as your new favorite Netflix show called Dave and Lauren. and really what you're talking about
totally
is
for the public to know.
Because it was funny. Ah. But I mean, really, it's the Boise mayor's race because there is so much going on with this. I mean, yes, so tongue in cheek. I mean, it could be a bit of a reality show, but we're talking the largest city in the state of Idaho, and our incumbent is really being challenged truly for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, you know, for folks who've covered local politics for a long time, like the three people sitting in the room, four people with Sam in the room here, it's different. And I think what's been really fascinating about this race is that people go, well, didn't Dave Beter nominate Lauren McClain to the city council in the first place? And they're like, why is she running against him? And so I kind of wanted to get to a little bit of the why there. And doing some, frankly, talking to people and then doing some research, it was interesting because in 2015, Lauren McClain had served on the CCDC with the mayor. The mayor appoints this panel, and CCDC is responsible for urban renewal in the city of Boise. And they disagreed pretty sharply over a proposal for a project that's now called the Water Cooler Downtown. And there were two proposals, one from Gardner Company and one from a company called Local Construct out of L.A. And the mayor really wanted the Gardner project to win, and Lauren McClain and several of the other CCDC commissioners were in favor of the Local Construct proposal. So it goes along, and it's striking because since I've been really covering CCDC closely starting in 2016, they almost always all vote together. And so it was interesting to go look back and look at minutes and listen to some audio recordings and see that on this project, the mayor was always in the minority over and over and over again on this project. And so the final vote comes down, and Local Construct gets the bid. The mayor basically says, I don't think this is right, and there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. 4 months later, he decided to recast the board, and he booted Lauren McClain, and he booted another city councilor at the time, David Eberle. And he replaced them with three other city council members, Scott Ludwig, Marianne Jordan, and Ben Quintana. Two of those have left the council. And it was interesting because the Statesman had a story on it at the time, and the mayor's spokesperson said that the mayor wanted to deepen the relationship between CCDC and the city council. Well, it's kind of a funny thing to say because he replaced two city council members with three other city council members. And that was kind of the first, I think, public split that you could see between these two politicians. I start my piece with kind of a – I'm not a narrative journalist. It's not my thing. But I tried to sort of paint this picture of a city council meeting that I sat in April where they were talking about wastewater. And, you know, sewage isn't exactly the most interesting topic, but
– to say the least.
But the mayor made a joke, and he said – there were seven options presented, and he asked the public works people, you know, you don't take a little bit of three and a little bit of five and give me some of number two, no pun intended on this, right? A few people kind of laugh in the room, but I was watching body language, which I often do, and I see Lauren McClain look over at the mayor like, that is so gross. Just had this look on her face like, what on earth? And I think it really illustrates the difference in style between politicians. There's a lot to this. You can read the story. It's 2,500 words, and there's a lot in it. But I think style is one sharp difference, but I think the policy between them is really different as well. Mm. And hopefully as we get into the race this fall, through reporting and through their own words, we'll really get to see how they're going to approach growth in coming years.
Well, and that's what I'm curious about, because since Beter did appoint her to the board, to city council, and, you know, the mayor only votes when it's a tie-breaking vote. So for the most part, you know, the city council seems to vote together.
Yeah, and Margaret Carmel, at the Betsy's colleague at the Idaho Press, did a really phenomenal story where she looked at, I think, a year's worth of votes and found that not just votes but meetings, the vast majority of the meetings had all unanimous votes.
Right.
And the mayor doesn't vote, so you can't say, well, Lauren and the mayor always vote together. They actually don't. In fact, one of the things that her analysis found was that when the mayor votes, it's because it's a tie, and usually Councilor McClain is in the minority. And so it's interesting because they do have a lot of similarities, but Lauren, Councilor McClain, has really been trying to, you know, drive some differences, and the mayor has been taking some incoming flack. There was a I think we actually talked about it in Idaho Matters. There was this idea to put in these face detection cameras at City Hall.
Right.
It was under a threshold where City Council had to approve it. I think Margaret actually dug that one up as well. Mm-hmm. And The next day, Councillor McLean issued a news release that was like, this is really crazy. We need to have a discussion about this. And then a week and a half later, late on a Friday afternoon, a news release came out saying, we're not going
to. Never mind. Yeah.
And there's been a couple of these things. And I've said to a couple of people, I think we're going to start to see some skeletons rise up.
Mm-hmm.
One of the points I try and make in the piece is Dave Veeder and Lorne McLean know each other very well. They sit next to each other. They spend a lot of time together. And I think they probably know where each other's sort of rough spots may be. Mm. And we've already seen this. There was a story in the Idaho Press. I'm standing like a broken record about this.
Yeah, there's a theme here, Idaho Press.
Right.
You should be reading the Idaho Press is what we're getting from this.
Really should. About these emails that have been forwarded to John Podesta and showed up in WikiLeaks and the sort of Russian hacking of John Podesta's emails that was leaked to try and damage Hillary Clinton. And the person anonymously told Margaret at the Idaho Press, like, hey, this shows that there's some dark money with Lorne McLean and the McLean campaign pushed back. I'm like, no, it doesn't really say that. But it's interesting because it made me go, gee, I wonder who pushed that, who sent that out. And so I think we're seeing a lot of that and a lot of back and forth between these two candidates, and they're just really interesting politicians, interesting to cover and an interesting dynamic, and it's going to be an interesting fall.
And they will be debating. I mean, there are already debates on the schedule.
That's good to know.
So, I'll just promote something really quick.
I will be there with balls on.
So August, I get the date right, August 26th or the 28th, I have to look at my calendar. I'll be moderating the debate between the two.
Yeah.
Actually, and I think that'll be really interesting. That I'm impressed that they are both willing to show up and have a conversation.
And I go to city council every week, and they have remained very collaborative. And you don't see a lot. There's some body language that, like I pointed out in the piece, and Mayor often kind of puts his shoulder to her back, and there's a difference in style there. But they continue to work together, and I think they realize that the city business is more important than the politics. But they're going to have to say, here's what I see for the future if I continue to be mayor, or here's what I see if I'm the new mayor. Right. That's going to be interesting for people to watch.
It's August 28th. I just checked my calendar.
I love it.
We're going to continue with the Friday Reporter Roundtable right after this. We're continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. My panel today, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, and Don Day with BoiseDev.com. Boise, this, Betsy, I'm going to go on vacation tomorrow, just so y'all know. So my brain is kind of somewhere else.
Let's talk about leave.
I know. Let's talk about paid leave. Yeah. I'm going to be gone next week. Betsy, this is the story that seems to never die. More developments coming up around the issues of diversity and inclusion that stemmed from a letter that former interim president Martin Schiff wrote. And this has to do with BSU.
Absolutely. There have been a number of developments this week. Among them, the Idaho Freedom Foundation has continued to just push really, really hard on this. They've been sending out lots of columns and so forth. And yesterday they sent out a fundraising letter trying to capitalize on this, saying that they're fighting the fight against segregation at Boise State and various other things like that, and that people ought to can really stand up to this by sending them a donation, which was interesting. And they've continued to push the narrative that Boise State holds segregated graduations by race. And this is actually not true. Boise State's official commencement ceremony, which takes place at Taco Bell Arena, and this year was on May 11th, is for the whole school. And in fact, this year it was so big that they had to divide it into two ceremonies on the same day by college. Everybody walks at commencement. The college and the interim president's letter also highlighted a lot of celebrations that occur on campus in the weeks leading up to commencement, including some by student groups, faith groups, colleges, departments, and so on, and two that were highlighted in the interim president's letter dealing with diversity and inclusion programs are events called Rainbow Graduation and Black Graduation. And so this mention caused some to read his letter as saying, oh, well, at Boise State, if you're black, you can only go to black graduation. That is not what is occurring. And so I have actually spoken with several legislators who signed the letter objecting to the diversity and inclusion programs And all of those I've spoken with so far have said, oh, well, if they're not segregating graduation, that's different. If they're just having a party, that's fine. Everybody should celebrate their graduation. But there are still some who are really concerned about this idea of having an event for people who, quote, identify as black, which is how the university phrased it. And if we're going to do that, are we going to have one for people who identify as white? Are we getting into supporting, you know, if we did that, everyone would object to be white supremacy. There's a lot of debate going on among legislators and among others about what diversity means, what inclusion means. But they're reaching out to the new BSU president, Marlene Trump. A number of them have got meetings scheduled with her. And I am hearing really from all sides, except for the Idaho Freedom Foundation, that the bottom line is the diversity is good. And that they all support it. And the question is how we get there and do we have a dialogue and are there misunderstandings?
So it sounds maybe language. I mean, if they say in this letter, the former interim president of BSU said black graduation, rainbow graduation, maybe if he said celebration.
Yes.
I mean, words matter.
They do indeed. The Idaho Freedom Foundation in particular has been choosing many strong words. Their most recent column suggested that Boise State is actually encouraging and incentivizing students and faculty toward self-immolation and marginalization. And I was a little taken aback by the self-immolation. I'm not sure how that fits in with people setting themselves on fire. But this controversy is not yet gone.
No, it's not.
And it will continue. There were additional developments this week. The Idaho Statesman actually had a story about some emails that it obtained from the Freedom Foundation to legislators suggesting that there's a push to get Dreamers or DACA students to get opportunity scholarships to Boise State. This was based on a sentence in the interim president's letter that the university later retracted and corrected. And now some legislators are saying they want to push legislation to make sure that does not happen.
Mm-hmm. Don, tell us what's going on with these proposed condos near downtown Boise, because this is actually what ended up in court. Not in court, but there's been in a...
No, but so WH Pacific and JO Construction want to build some condos along the Boise River on a little slice of land between Catherine Albertson Park and the river. It used to be the KOA campground, I believe. And there is a difference of opinion between the developer and some folks who live on the rim. And the people who live on the rim are Jamie Scott and Joe Scott. Those folks are noteworthy because they are the heirs of the Albertson family. They are also currently involved in helping to redevelop Albertson Park, which they oversee from their homes. They hired an expert that differed with the expert hired by the developer and showed that these condos are really going to block the view. Well, Idaho law, state law, city law, there is no provision for view, right? Because you can't really decide what is a view blockage and what's not. There's no law against blocking a view. But the Planning and Zoning Commission of the City of Boise said, well, okay, you know what? You are going to need an exemption to go to 80 feet here. The zoning here is 45 feet. So let's split the difference and we'll give you 62 feet. And they came to that through some reason. It wasn't just a random number. But so they made this decision. They tried to compromise. The Planning and Zoning Commission did. And it immediately drew appeals, two of them. One from the Scots, who say, well, no, that's too high. It should be lower. It should be 45 feet. And one from the developer who said, no, that's too low. It should be higher. We need the 80 feet. So now Boise City Council in September gets the fun task of trying to sort this all out and figuring out what exactly makes sense, trying to decide which of the two experts' drawings are accurate. And the Planning and Zoning Commission made a point to say, you know, and in fact, it was kind of a funny moment because the attorney for the Scott family said, you know, we can't really appeal on the view. And then they all have already just talked about the view for half an hour as I'm reading the minutes. And so Commissioner Milt Gillespie on the Planning and Zoning said, you said it up front that you can't appeal on the view. And they spent 30 minutes talking about the bleeping view. It's kind of funny. And so we'll see what happens. City Council's got to sort this out. Housing advocates are saying we need more housing.
Right.
And if you cut this down, cut it in half, it's going to be a lot fewer houses and housing units. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. These are going to be high-end sort of condo units right on the river in Greenbelt. If you're fortunate enough to be able to live here, it'll be a nice place to go. And even people who are looking for affordable housing think, and I shouldn't speak universally, but some who talk to me think, any additional inventory of housing units are important because it helps free up
other
whole
housing.
Spectrum yes. of housing units. So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes.
Mike, I think you guys did a fascinating story concerning the rescue mission, the Boise rescue mission, regarding having to, I wouldn't say sign a contract, but you have to agree to certain stipulations if you want to go through the rescue mission's recovery program.
Right. So our reporter, Madeline White, has been doing some pretty deep reporting in the homeless community and the things that they are going through. One person approached our station this week saying that when she showed up at the Boise Rescue Mission, an organization to which she's donated money in the past and volunteered, and she was hoping to sign her 22-year-old daughter up for drug treatment program. It asks the question on the document about whether or not you are willing to live by a heterosexual lifestyle, because that's what's recognized by the organization. It's a yes or no question. Now, none of us in this room are super new. The issue of adding the words isn't a new debate. The organization has every right to ask that question. However, it begged a bigger question about the value of that question in the first place. What happens if you write no? The Boise Rescue Mission argues that they don't refuse service. They just may ask further questions and try to encourage you to live by that lifestyle. And separately, what types of programs are available that don't ask that question? Mm-hmm. If you don't feel comfortable writing no when you are homosexual or identify differently, where do you go? And the answer is there aren't a ton of other opportunities. There are some programs that go up to about 30 days, but if you need a deeper, more intensive program that goes 90 days and above, those options just aren't there. Mm-hmm. So we ended up having a conversation with the Department of Health and Welfare where they are making the case, hopefully, that with Medicaid expansion, some of these programs, especially for those in that coverage gap, that there will be programs that will pop up when that funding mm-hmm. is available. But as of now, that's not there.
And we should note that within this story that Madeline did, that I mean, the rescue mission is a private entity.
Right,
so
right.
So they can do
No, they can legally do whatever
legally,
they want.
Legally, they can do whatever they
want. Right,
yeah. Betsy, quickly before, because we're running out of time, Medicaid expansion. Governor Little has said a little bit more about this.
He did. Well, he gave his address to the business community this week. And there have been all these developments in court, or this comes up in the feds, and the question continually is raised, what will that mean for Idaho's Medicaid expansion? He pretty much settled that. He said, regardless of what happens in D.C. or what happens in the court, Idaho is expanding Medicaid on January 1, and we are full steam ahead.
And there you go. Don, wrap us up with Hannafin's. This is one of the oldest businesses, correct, in the city of Boise?
Yeah, so Hannafin's, until this week, was the longest-running business in a single location in the city of Boise. It made it 111 years. It was opened in 1909. I wrote the story on Monday, so that 1909 at 9th. I'm sorry, at 11th and Main. Tell me to
you
do it quickly,
on vacation
and I screw
too?
It up. No, not get vacations. Anyway, so Hannafin Cigar Shop, most people know, has been open for a really long time at Boise. The owner decided to call it quits, and so it is now closed. I'm hearing that another nearby business is going to expand into that space, and so we'll see what's come for the future of the Hannafin.
But we don't know what the business would be.
I do, but I don't have it confirmed, so I don't want to say that.
Oh, all right, okay. Well, maybe next time you're on.
Yeah.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today. Our guest, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side, Betsy Russell with Idaho Press, and Don Day with BoiseDev.com. Always love this segment and spending time with you guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, using galaxy clusters to look backward in time. I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters.